Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and this is my view of Russia in Moscow's shadows. Let me remind you that you can also follow my blog, also called In Moscow's Shadows, and I'm on Twitter at Mark Galliotti and Facebook at Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast of wholly variable length, frequency and format is produced in part thanks to its supporters on Patreon, who, depending on their generosity, also get access to exclusive materials and other perks. If you'd like to join them, just head on to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. Now, on to today's show. On the 7th of May, police in Moscow carried out an arrest. It was pretty exciting stuff. Commandos from the GROM, that's Thunder, police special operations team, abseiled down the outside of the building and burst in through the windows, just as another armed team cut through the door with a power saw. So, who was the dangerous felon who needed to be apprehended in such a high-profile way? A terrorist? A drug lord? A gunrunner? No, it was an ex-trade unionist turned social media host. The brute. Let me just turn to the indictment. It reads, this is a direct quote, Vorontsov, together with unidentified persons, acting jointly and agreed, being in an unidentified place on the territory of Moscow at an exactly undefined time, but no later than the period from 1st to 6th of October 2017, committed extortion. That hardly sounds like a rock-solid case. In fact, what I want to do is to talk about this case, about what happened when the authorities went after Vladimir Vorontsov, and while you may feel you have no particular interest in police trade unionism, bear with me, because I want to use this case to explore some wider issues about community, about solidarity, and about protests in Russia that should, if you're listening, Volva, even raise some concerns for Putin. So, Vorontsov, he's an ex-cop who served for 13 years, and like, to be blunt, many police officers, he had his distinct beefs with how the force was run, the corruption of the higher-ups, the illegalities, and sometimes outright lunacy of many regulations. Unlike most cops, though, instead of simply ventilating over a drink or four after a tough shift, after leaving the service, he got involved in an informal police trade union and then set up the Police Ombudsman Network, which is an interesting hybrid of a one-man human rights NGO and a social media hub. And its aim was to address the concerns and mistreatment of the police officers. Now, there clearly is an audience. Police Ombudsman Telegram channel has 98,000 subscribers. That's nothing to its Vkontakte page, which is the Russian equivalent to Facebook, which has more than 383,000 subscribers. And for comparison, and while obviously not all of these subscribers are going to be serving police officers, but nonetheless, Russia has just over 900,000 police in total, when you also include people who don't really ever see the beat but are working behind the scenes. He clearly got under someone's skin. Now, why now in particular? It's likely because there's currently some amendments to the law on the police which are being considered, several of which give them distinctly sweeping new powers and also undermine one of the real advances we've seen in police reform, which is officers' requirement to identify themselves. Police officers now have badges with very clear identifiable numbers on them, and in my experience are actually very good about identifying themselves in their interactions with the members of the public. However, this amendment would, in a nice little twist round, make it a requirement for civilians immediately to identify themselves fully anytime an officer asks. But the police just have to identify themselves at some point, so potentially well after the real incident happens. The real area of concern, though, is broadening the scope for police officers to be able to use their guns in deadly force, making it much, much more of a subjective judgment about whether or not they perceive any kind of threat. Now, given that we've seen some rather farcical cases of protesters arrested for assault after throwing plastic cups and bottles of water at fully armoured riot squads, no wonder there were concerns about giving them more latitude to use deadly force. And Vorontsov was outspoken on this. He was alarmed the vagueness might lead to tragic situations, but also because, from Vorontsov's point of view, given his own particular perspective, He felt it could leave police officers themselves vulnerable because, as he told an interviewer for Novaya Zvezdia, the investigative committee will sacrifice and prosecute police officers who may have used their weapons correctly. Well, that's a pretty impressive way to piss off in one go both the Interior Ministry hierarchy and the investigative committee, and perhaps we shouldn't have been surprised in hindsight that his card was marked. In April, he was accused under new laws which are against spreading of disinformation about coronavirus, which, yes, often does actually mean information that the government doesn't want spread. Anyway, he was accused of having posted a story on Kontaktier about cases amongst police cadets. Now, once again, the circumstances of this case are distinctly iffy, and frankly, this was probably more of a warning, and it was one that he obviously didn't heed. And the next step was the armed snatch, and this charge of being involved in blackmailing a police officer who had, charmingly enough, distributed a photo of his own genitalia back in 2017. Lovely. This was a wholly unnecessarily dramatic raid. But that was probably the point. This was about the theatre of repression, a high-profile statement of intent, and also a warning to other potential whistleblowers and malcontents. But here is where it starts to get interesting. Cops, some incognito, but many, and absolutely kudos to them, openly identifying themselves, started cropping up on social media with the hashtag Free Vorontsov. Others gave interviews to the press, and a petition began circulating that, even within hours, had 5,000 signatories. Again, a public statement, that's an interesting thing. United Russia Duma deputy Alexander Hinstein, formerly aide to the head of the National Guard, and a man as likely to be called a bleeding heart liberal as I am to be called a sports-loving man of the people, even raised Vorontsov's case with the new Prosecutor General. Now look, this case is still up in the air, and who knows what will happen. As in other cases, such as that of the journalist Ivan Golunov show, people can be let free if their case begins to look embarrassing and politically expensive enough for the bosses. We'll have to see. But there are some wider points, three wider points, that I'd like to make. The first one is that Russian cops are cops. Unlike most academics, and I suspect probably most Russians, I've actually tried to make a point of talking to Russian police over the years. And there has been an interesting change, I would suggest, in their culture over the times. Look, in the 1990s, this was a very, very bad time to be a police officer, probably even more so than many other Russians, and the 1990s was pretty horrible for most. It was extraordinarily dangerous. They were underappreciated, underfunded, underpaid. The average Moscow beat cop was being paid less than a Moscow bus driver, is worth mentioning. And perhaps then we should be unsurprised at the extraordinary levels of not just corruption, but the kind of predatory corruption, where they would actually go out and more or less extort money from people. Because they felt let down by society, they felt let down by the authorities, and also it was almost invariably, in my experience, justified when you talk to them about having to look after their families and so forth. Well, that was the bad 1990s, and I think since then there has been a very real change, particularly as a new, younger generation of cops come into the service. Increasing professionalisation, but more to the point, I think a genuine sense of an identity as a police officer and a desire to do the job. Look, I'm not going to say that this transition is any way complete. There still is corruption, there still is a lot of unprofessionalism, and frankly, a lot of us and them sense of within their relationship with society. But even there, we do see positive change. That, for example, the notion of what we could call generally accepted corruption has changed. There is still corruption, but in my experience, the moral economy has been shifting. So, as it were, the invisible but commonly understood line that divides the acceptable perks of the job, shall we say, from being a bad cop, have slowly but perceptibly shifted. I mean, the line I've used in the past is I strongly suspect that in the 1990s, I could be standing over the body of a recent murder victim, bloody axe in hand, and if my wallet was thick enough, I'd probably be still walking free. Now that kind of thing doesn't happen. Sure, if you're a migrant labourer, you may well still get shaken down. But generally speaking, it's actually a sense more that if people pay, it is for better service, shall we say, have their cases expedited. Or else it's a fine by other name. I remember once talking to a traffic cop who said that obviously you couldn't possibly take a bribe to turn a blind eye if there was an accident when someone got hurt. But if it was just that you catch someone speeding, well, look, if they pay the official fine or if they pay the traffic cop, they're still paying. So he rationalised it, and let's be honest, humans are extraordinarily efficient engines at rationalisation. But anyway, he rationalised it as, in a way, it was still teaching this person a lesson. So yes, there's still corruption, but on a different kind of scale. What they are not, I would suggest, is all committed stormtroopers of the Kremlin. Indeed, it actually looks as if one looks, for example, at the violent suppression of peaceful protests, worth stressing that, peaceful protests in Moscow in the summer of last year, that seems so, so long away. At first, actually, police hung back compared to the, shall we say, rather more enthusiastic National Guard. Then they mucked in more. But as I understand it, it's actually because the Rosgvardia, and especially their maximalist head, Viktor Zolotov, actually complained that the police weren't pulling their weight, and therefore the police were forced to up their game. But this isn't their natural instinct. And indeed, one of the reasons for actually creating the National Guard in 2016 was precisely because of the Kremlin's concerns that if it did actually want to unleash the thugs on the streets, that is the uniformed thugs, the police would not necessarily be committed to this mission. So let's not all assume that the boys in blue are entirely do-or-die Putinistas. And therefore that says some interesting things about the algorithms of power, if, again, push comes to shove. It's worth remembering that in the 1991 August coup by the hardliners against Mikhail Gorbachev, although the Interior Minister, Boris Pugot, was an absolutely committed member of the emergency committee behind the coup, actually, the majority of street police officers on that crucial first day called in sick, that being the safest or easiest way to avoid being called on potentially to crack your neighbour's skull, while at the same time not burning any bridges. We have a tendency to assume that the security apparatus is entirely affiliated with Putin and entirely has subsumed within itself the ideology of the sort of the ultra-nationalists, the paranoid xenophobes who see everything as a struggle against an interfering West. Not necessarily true. And that leads me to my second point, which is actually about communities. I think it was really, really very interesting that the police actually went into wider social media and adopted many of the strategies of other protest movements, hashtags and all, that we have seen in cases. Again, I mentioned the Golunov case, but there are many others. In other words, the police were not just simply confining themselves to their own. They were demonstrating a definite sense of community of cops. But then again, cops banding together to defend one of their own is perhaps we should expect. And it was interesting to note that according to the newspaper Moskovsky Komsomolets, the police who were initially instructed to escort Vorontsov to court actually refused. They refused explicitly in solidarity with him, and therefore they had to call on some officers from the 2nd Operational Regiment, which is like the remaining Moscow riot police unit, to do the job. So, you know, it's actually really quite a distinct strand of opinion within the police, and they're willing to stand up. But as I said, cops defending cops is one thing. The fact is, though, that they're trying to reach out to wider communities, I think, is particularly telling. Now, you know, many, especially the sort of protester types, may generally regard Russian police with the same kind of esteem that street cleaners might view stag parties. And it's certainly that they have all kinds of reasons to feel resentment. But in general, there has been a slow improvement in the public perception of the police. It's been a slow but a steady improvement. And it has to be said, this is one of the key objectives that Interior Minister Vladimir Kolokoltsev has. Not just for the warm fuzzies, but actually a police force that has a high level of public legitimacy is a much more effective police force. And the police even seem to be reaching out. But here we have the interesting spectacle of the police, generally seen as part of the state, actually turning to civil society in their campaigns against the state. I think this demonstrates an awareness of the power of community. This is, after all, a victim-blaming criticism that's often made about Russian society, that it is atomized, fragmented, lacking in solidarity within but above all between groups, and that this makes it weak before the state. Well, maybe. But the evidence is that this is something people are trying to change. It's worth noting that Ksenia Sobchak, that rather strange hybrid of liberal oppositionist and opportunistic it girl, has already come out in support of Vorontsov. And likewise, we've also got the Presidential Council on Human Rights willing to take up his case. In other words, actually, even a relatively despised category such as the police are ones that are now being taken into the bosom of groups that once upon a time would have been rather more critical. Now, it may be just simply that they feel that Vorontsov's case is right and proper. It may well be that in some cases they are seeing that it's actually quite useful to use this as an opportunity to woo the police. But one way or the other, it's about communities coming together. And this leads me to my third and most general point, which is about, shall I say, the instincts of protest. Look, although it's not what it only is, Russia is an authoritarian state. So there is relatively little space for true independent civil society, especially civil society that tries to change political decisions, and frankly, everything is political. But that is not the same as no space, and this is one of the things that I feel very strongly about, that I think a lot of outside observers, and indeed inside commentators, underestimate the extent to which there is actually quite a vibrant, small-scale civil society, even if almost a semi-covert or euphemistic one. There are industrial protests and movements. There are all kinds of social activities and so forth. These are protests, these are campaigns, these are attempts to influence policy. And they are allowed, indeed sometimes even pandered to by the state, so long as they observe what we could call a certain etiquette. They stay local and they pretend that they are not about politics, that they're not about big picture politics, they're not about the system, they're just about a specific local case. This rubbish dump, this school that hasn't been rebuilt, this road that needs to be reopened or whatever. Now, we may all know that in fact the reasons for these protests are the corruption, the inefficiencies, the unresponsiveness of the Kremlin. But the point is, we all have to pretend that's not the case, and if so, we're allowed to get away with it. Now, that's good, but there is a risk, a danger with this, is that it becomes self-limiting, that people only aim low because that's safe and that's where you actually might accomplish things. Movements and protests like this, which are public and push the boundaries, shall we say, of the acceptable, I think are really important because in some ways they're like a political rehab. They're like kind of the post-op physio to rebuild atrophied and damaged muscle and with it body memory. Key strength of authoritarian regimes, after all, is not in repression, but in control of their public's expectations and, in a way, their optimism. On a sideline, why do, in Western societies, middle class, and here I'm talking about the British concept of middle class, which by American concept means upper middle class, activists and civil society tend to have much more traction in local affairs? Yes, of course, to a considerable extent, it's because of their wealth and their contacts and their organisational capacities. However, it's also about confidence and a cycle of expectation. They manage to change something, and so they expect to be able to change something, and so they try and do it again. Whereas actually working class experiences are often very different. Their efforts are hamstrung not just by their very, very real political and economic constraints, but also an expectation of powerlessness. If you don't think you can succeed at something, then why on earth do you put time and effort and sometimes run risks in the name of trying to change anything? To protest is to affirm optimism, to perform as a citizen rather than a subject. Now, without devaluing, obviously, the activities of those such as Alexei Navalny on the big picture scene, it is these kind of wider acts that will, bit by bit, and again, I don't want to overplay it, but bit by bit, galvanize society and create potential bonds of solidarity. and habits of protest. I think that's an important thing, a habit of protest that can truly challenge the state's legitimacy, but also its confidence. And it really would be quite an irony if actually that came initially from the police. So that's the Vorontsov case, and we'll see what happens. Now, the Alert podcast listener will have noticed that this is actually the fourth podcast in 4 weeks, when all I ever actually promised was at least one per month. I cannot guarantee to be able to keep up this kind of strike rate. To a considerable extent, it depends on whether I have the time and whether I have things that I actually want to say. But to a considerable extent, this is thanks to my patrons, whose support makes devoting time to this project all the more viable, and very much my thanks to them. If you want to join their hallowed ranks, then head to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. One of the perks, beyond just simply knowing that you support this podcast and make it more, I was going to say common, but there's nothing common about this podcast, frequent, is that actually you do get to ask me, depending on your tier, questions to address. And so in the second half, what I want to do is tackle three more questions from three more esteemed patrons. Now, the first question I was asked, and a particularly interesting, almost conceptual one, is why do I use the term late Putinism for what we have now? Why not thinking it as mature Putinism? It's grown up, it's middle-aged Putinism, it's settled and comfortable in its middle-aged spread. Well, in some ways it's a very fair comment, and really we will only know when we're much, much older, and we can look back over this period in hindsight. Because for me, what makes this late Putinism is precisely that I think the system is losing or has lost its capacity to evolve. That in some ways, this is the last stage. And really, I think 2014 was the crucial point, either that marked it or actually is when we saw it. This is one reason why, for example, holding up my hands, I was wrong about the annexation of Crimea. I didn't think Putin would do it because I was still thinking with the mindset of a previous Putin that was rather more pragmatic, rather less consumed with his notion of his sense in history. And that's why I thought, actually, the Russians aren't going to go so far as to annex it. I were wrong. But as is, I think, we now have a Putin that you might say having used its last life to move to this stage of this quite aggressive geopolitical campaign, perceived, I think, genuinely in the name of defense of Russia's place in the world, defense of Russia's status as a great power. I think that we are not seeing a Russia that is able to respond in anything else. I mean, one can witness as what for me is the terrible failure of the regime properly to deal with the pandemic. And a lack of new ideas, we may well see many new tactics emerging, but nothing conceptual. I think they're locked into this mindset and to the point of almost beginning to become a caricature of itself, which again is a classic thing that we see in all authoritarian leaders of any stripe. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about Margaret Thatcher or Saddam Hussein, that at a certain point they cocoon themselves in yes people, they surround themselves with people who are going to flatter their own assumptions about the world. Excluding alternative perspectives is one way of excluding the capacity to grow as a result. And this is contributing to a certain, in my opinion, fin de siècle feel. Now, this might sound perverse in that at the same time there are people talking about the fact that with the constitutional changes, Putin might be around for a long, long time to come. But whether we're talking about people thinking on the succession and a post-Putin Russia, or whether they're thinking about an eternal Putinism. Either way, actually, these are signs of a sense that this is no longer business as usual, that in fact we now have a regime which is inflexible to the point of ossification. Now, sometimes inflexible regimes can hang around for a long time. Sometimes they can be broken. And we'll have to see what kind of pressures might break it. I mean, to be honest, had it not been for World War I, the Tsarist regime would have stumbled on a long time. But to be honest, it was like a dinosaur whose tiny little brain had not yet quite worked out that the body was dead. So this is my own take, but as I said, it is a terribly subjective one and may well be totally wrong. And the final point is, I think, because precisely it is Putinism. It is about this fixation on one person, which is for me a mark of decadence in the truest sense of the word. But we'll see. Now, the second question is about generational change within the security services. Now, look, this is something, at the risk of sounding like a trailer, that I want to look in more detail in a future podcast. But my sense is that on one level, yes, there is a generational change that matters, but we shouldn't overstate it, because this is a very, very self-regenerating kind of institution. I mean, first of all, the security services, because they are an exceedingly cushy gig, have become essentially increasingly hereditary. So, you know, when they were infamously described as the new nobility, well, that also extends to the inbreeding too. Secondly, they're self-selecting. Precisely, they tend to pick the people who are like them, who share their kind of mindset. They're not going to be looking for radicals and free thinkers. And finally, even for those outsiders who do manage to get in, there is a high level of socialization. And again, this is actually something that is really quite common to most institutions generally, but I think particularly security services, which do tend to be very self-encapsulated social worlds. I mean, this is probably tremendously unfair, but nonetheless, my own experiences of my contacts with people within the British Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, is that they may well not all be lovely, affable chaps and chapesses from Oxford or Cambridge, but nonetheless, within a year or two of having been in the service, they certainly all sound like it. That's a very petty example, I know, but I think it's important to realise the extent to which actually institutions create their people, just as people create the institutions. Now, there has been, that said, a certain kind of generational change. Put very crudely, in the 1990s, there was chaos, and frankly, in that period, there was, I think, a considerable outbleeding of the most talented individuals, and they went into corporate security and all kinds of other activities, just as a fair number of the less talented ones went into taxi driving and the like. In the noughts, that's when we really had this notion of a new nobility emerging. People who could do very, very well for themselves, while at the same time feel that they were carrying out the mission of the newly reconstituted, the newly competent Russia. In the teens and through now, I think what we've seen is an increasing division, frankly, between their ostensible purpose and mission and their own corrupt and cynical experiences. And I think this is going to be an interesting thing to look at in the future. I mean, actually, are they comfortable just simply with the thought of all their perks and the fact that they are contributing in robbing their country blind in their own, or sometimes quite small ways? Or will they feel that their mission truly matters? Because, as I was saying in the first part, with the police, we shouldn't assume that all of them are committed Putinists. Some are, if anything, much more nationalistic, and they're precisely that kind of nationalist flank that Putin does have to consider and does actually constrain his options. And again, in a future podcast, I do plan to look at people like Strelkov, the man who, by his own account, pulled the trigger on the Ukrainian war. Then there are people who, I wouldn't want to go so far as to call them closet liberals, but at least are westernizers. They're people who've seen the West and actually appreciate certain aspects of it, including often a degree of rule of law, you know, so long as it doesn't impact on their own quality of life too much. And that really leads me to where I think most of them are, which is opportunists. They want to be on the winning side. Now, at the moment, there's no question but that the current incumbent of the Kremlin, his side, seems to be the winning side. But if things changed, I really don't think that we should assume that these are people who would go to the wall to defend it. We should think about how actually easily the KGB, meant to be the sword and shield of the revolution, adapted to the collapse of the Soviet state and how they became the most assiduous, in some ways, ultra-capitalists and embezzlers. So likewise, let's not assume that today's modern security state is absolutely willing to defend the Putinist order no matter what, assuming they're given escape routes. And in a way, that actually acts as an interesting segue to the third and final question, which is a huge one, so I'm going to treat it very, very broadly, which is, what has NATO done right or wrong with respect to Russia since Putin's invasion of Crimea? Well, first of all, I'm going to assume that really we're talking about NATO members rather than NATO as an institution, because NATO as an institution is essentially a military and defensive one. And given that Ukraine and so forth is not part of NATO, technically it's not really part of its mission. So it's easy to criticise Western response, and in a moment I intend to. But I think we also have to acknowledge that particularly when it comes to Ukraine, this was always going to be an incredibly difficult challenge. Perhaps most importantly of all, because of an asymmetry, not just in political will between Russia and the West, but in how important this conflict is. Ukraine, to put it bluntly, matters more to Putin than it does to the West. And let's not pretend otherwise. And it's not just Ukraine itself, it's also that having committed himself into it in sort of this ridiculous and bloody and frankly pointless intervention into the Donbass in order to try and force Kyiv to recognise, quote-unquote, that it's part of Russia's sphere of influence, Putin cannot frankly back down without being able to claim some kind of mission accomplished moment. He has to claim a victory. That is, I think, pretty central both to his own self-image and also to his political status as the man who never makes a mistake. Trust me, you go back and try and find a case of Putin acknowledging a mistake, which isn't a mistake in the sense of, yes, I made a mistake in trusting these underlings to actually do it right. He's not a man prone to public doubts. So, for me, the big issue is that we focused on deterrence, and deterrence not only of the wrong thing, because I don't believe Putin has territorial ambitions in Western Europe, but also not appreciating the extent to which, from a different perspective, deterrence can look like aggression. And the trouble is, and it's a point I've made before, is that Putin and his cohorts have a very, very skewed and frankly quite paranoid view of the West. But nonetheless, it does mean that they convince themselves that efforts to deny what they think of as Russia's rightful place in the world actually are aggression. Doesn't necessarily mean we shouldn't have done anything, but I think we really need to appreciate the extent to which we're in not a military but a political struggle. This is political war, as George Kennan conceived it, and that therefore it needed a suitable range of options. And that meant, first of all, demonstrating deterrence in the sense of deterrence by denial. We needed to address, and we still need to address, the opportunities and weaknesses within Western societies that the Russians are exploiting. Whether that's communities that feel marginalised, whether that's that however much we talk about the struggle against dirty money, that we really don't want to do anything about it, and that provides all kinds of opportunities for corruption and leverage. The examples are myriad. So we need to basically create resilience and create fewer opportunities for Russian interference. Secondly, what we needed to do was to demonstrate solidarity. Again, this is the interesting thing. NATO is this extraordinarily potent instrument of solidarity against potential military threats. The idea that an attack on one is an attack on all. We've never really had and still haven't really demonstrated that solidarity against any other kind of threat. The Skripal, post-Skripal rather, wave of international coordinated expulsions was not only, quite frankly, a triumph for British diplomacy, it was also an extraordinary example of countries that may not have had direct skin in the game, but who nonetheless felt it was important to demonstrate to Russia that its behaviour was not appropriate. That could have been the start of something really important. A sign that, likewise with meddling in politics, cyber attacks, subversion, whatever, an attack on one is an attack on all. Trouble is, we haven't really seen it get anywhere. And particularly I was disappointed with the response to the murder of a Chechen in Berlin at the end of last year, in which actually the Germans didn't seem to do anything to try and make it an international issue. Now, I understand their reasoning, and it's a perfectly sort of valid perspective. I just happen to feel it was wrong. I think that actually the momentum needed to be continued, because the trouble is in Moscow, I think this has been interpreted as a sign that in fact the West is indeed as weak and as flabby as they thought, and that the Skripal event was a one-off, and essentially they can return to business as usual. But the third element is actually also outreach. We have to appreciate that Putin doesn't just believe that the West is hostile. He is trying to use that as part of his legitimating narrative with his own population. That yes, times are hard, but that's because we face all this interference and sanctions and so forth from the West. We are a beleaguered fortress because the world hates Russians, and that's why we all have to essentially ignore our various political differences and do what the motherland requires, which of course means do what Putin says. We need to appreciate, first of all, that actually the reason for the stridency of Putin's propaganda is precisely because this is not working. If one looks at polling, when Russians are asked, do you think your country has an enemy? Lowest figures since 2014. If they're asked about their attitudes towards various foreign countries, including the United States and the UK and so forth, actually these are much more positive. There will be a Russia after Putin. And I think what we therefore need to be doing is, on the one hand, being very tough, demonstrate that there are absolute red lines and that we will act in solidarity, while at the same time making it clear that we have a problem with certain Kremlin actions, but we don't have a problem with Russia or Russians. Now, this is a soapbox issue. I know I've said very similar things in my previous podcast about the Great Patriotic War. But nonetheless, well, hey, it's my podcast, so I get to rant if I want to. But secondly, when it comes down to it, what do we do right or wrong? We did various things that were useful. We supported Ukraine militarily as well as economically, and we are encouraging it to follow a reform path. We made it clear that certain aspects of Russian policy were inappropriate. We put forward defences into eastern parts of NATO countries to reassure member states. You know, all of that is very useful. But the trouble is, there is, in my opinion, no true strategy, and particularly not a true awareness of why Russia is doing what it is. It is not trying to destroy democracy in the West. It doesn't care. It is not trying to bring down the entire international order. That very international order gives it much more traction and leverage in the world than it would otherwise have. It is actually a case of a certain particular generation at a particular time. The last generation of Homo Sovieticus leaders, in the immediate period of post-imperial trauma, railing against the coming of the dark and that Russia is no longer a great power. This is transitional. We have to get through it, we have to endure it, and we have to try and think of some way of doing that which is more productive and more positive than just simply endorsing strategic patience, which means hunker down and wait for it to pass. Anyway, end of my rant, and I apologise for indulging myself with it. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/InMoscowShadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.